me and my house. Let me tell you about me and my house. In my house, one of our favorite times is meal time. And one of our favorite foods is pizza. In my house, our preferred recreation is getting out in creation and seeing nature. In my house, our chief desire is to grow in faith and to walk with God. Now, those are just some things that are true about my house. What is your house known for? Presently, all five of my children attend a karate class in Continental Ranch. And they've been doing that for a couple of years now, and they're all blue belts, or about halfway through the system. The particular studio that they're attending right now is taught by a family of black belts. Two parents, two daughters, and a son all have black belts, and all at various times have been my kids' instructors. In fact, they have a motto. Their family motto is, "The family that kicks together sticks together." So when it comes to that house, I can tell you, they are known for karate. What is your home known for? You know, our country is full of passionate people. We are passionate about sports, but right now, all of us that are sports fans are in a little bit of a crisis here. We have to watch reruns of things that happened some time ago. Some homes are passionate about food or about cars. Others about politics. And some homes, they major on relaxation. But every home is known for something. What is your home known for? In one of the most stirring declarations in the Bible, Joshua goes on record. He wants the Israelites to know what his house will be known for. In this message entitled, "Me and My House," I want you to notice what Joshua said about his house. This is Joshua 24, verses 14 and 15. The Bible says, "Now therefore fear the Lord and serve Him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood and in Egypt, and serve ye the Lord. And if it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land ye now dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." Let me remind you that Joshua is God's chosen leader of the Israelites. Moses was used of God to bring the Israelites out of Egypt, through the Red Sea, through the wilderness, and Moses brought them right up to the banks of the Jordan River, which is east of Israel. At that point, God said Moses' work was done. It was time for a new leader, and that new leader is Joshua. Now, his job is going to be to take them over the River Jordan and take possession of the promised land. When we read Joshua 24, we're actually reading the last part of Joshua's life. He's already completed his work of bringing the Israelites in. They now possess the land, and it has been allotted to them, to each of their tribes. But Joshua is concerned. He knows that he's not going to be on the scene much longer, and he wants to make sure that future generations of Israelites follow the Lord the same way that he did. So he knows that his time is shortly going to be up, and he wants to steer them in the right direction. And he goes on record and says, "Me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord." So I want you to ask this question this morning, if you're a dad especially. What can a dad do to steer his family to serve God? That's really the essence of the message. What can a dad do to steer his family to love and to serve God? I recognize the fact that some of you are not dads. I recognize the fact that some of you have already, your kids have already grown, and they're pretty much out of the home, though you still might have some influence over them. But I want to say that everybody here, whatever your status is, you still have influence either over other members in your home or extended family. And for that reason, I want you to consider, what can a dad do? What can a man do to steer his family to serve God? I want to give you three things here from the example of Joshua that should help you to steer your family to follow God. The first one is this: Joshua invites them to choose whom they will serve. So point number one, are the choices. And he sets before them a pretty clear choice in our text. In verse number 15, he said, you could serve the gods which your father served on the other side of the flood. Now that sounds a little odd to us. We think it might be talking about Noah's great flood, and it's not. The Hebrew word actually means river. And the river in the Bible is the Euphrates River. And so he's talking about Abraham. You could serve the gods that your father Abraham served before he found out about Jehovah God and God led him to the promise. You could serve those other gods way on the other side of the Euphrates. You could serve the gods that you knew your family forefathers knew down in Egypt. But he says, as for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord. So you could serve other gods or serve the Lord. You know what? That might sound ancient to you, but that is as relevant as the 21st century in June of the 2020 in which you live, because everybody either serves God or gods of their own making, even to this day. Well, what does it mean to serve? What's he talking about? He isn't talking necessarily about priestly service as if you've got to become a pastor or a priest or something. To serve, I like this definition by Warren Wiersbe. It's coming on the screen now. To serve God means to fear Him. Notice that back in verse number 14, the first thing that Joshua said, now therefore, fear the Lord. That means not to be afraid of Him, but to reverence Him and respect Him, obey Him and worship only Him. It means to love Him and fix your heart upon Him, obeying Him because you want to and not because you have to. So Joshua is talking about the devotion of people's hearts. He's talking about whom they're going to follow and whom they're going to love, whom they're going to obey the rest of their lives. Will those Israelites still follow God when Joshua is dead and gone? And you know what? That's a good question for every dad to ask. Will the people I know and love still serve God when I'm dead and gone? You know, we're so used to making choices, we make them all the time. We make hundreds of them every day. Am I going to wear blue or black today? Will we have time for breakfast today, or will I skip and just eat a bigger lunch? Will I order a chicken sandwich for lunch, or I'll have the burger instead? Will I read a book in the evening or watch a movie? Each day, our lives are made up of hundreds of choices, but the same is true about our lives. Our lives are really a collection of the choices that we're making. So when Joshua says to the people, choose you this day whom you will serve, he's not just talking about a simple matter. Yay, I'm going to throw my hat in that direction since the bandwagon says, choose you this day whom you'll serve. I'll serve God. No, he isn't saying that. He's saying, I want you to make a life choice that involves choice after choice to follow God. So he wants them to see the long-range importance of making good choices. And what a guy to tell us about this. I want you to notice that choices were a big part of Joshua's life, and therefore he is an authority, or is an expert really, on being able to encourage you and me to make good choices. Hey, think about this. He was first. In fact, the first appearance of Joshua's name in the Bible is in Exodus 17, shortly after the Exodus out of Egypt. And I want you to notice the text. The first verb that appears with Joshua when he comes out of the land of Egypt. Let's look at this. Exodus 17, verse 8. Then came Amalek and fought with Israel in Rephidim. And Moses said unto Joshua, what's the next word?
Choose.
It is the same word in our text. The first time I see Joshua's name in the Bible, he's been asked by Moses, would you choose us out some men so we can go into battle and we can take care of Amalek? Now, who's Amalek? Amalek was a nomadic Arabian tribe group of people. And when Israel was marching through the wilderness all those years, the Amalekites would come in behind and they would attack the tail end of the wagon train. And they would decimate and pillage and plunder the weakest among the people and carry off plunder for themselves. And so this had gone on for a while, and finally God said, Moses, tell Joshua to choose out some men because it's time to take care of the Amalekites who keep afflicting you in the wilderness. And you know what? Joshua did choose to follow Moses' direction. And here's the result in verse number 13. And Joshua discomfited, it means to disabled. The word actually means to prostrate. And you know what prostrate means? To put people flat out on the ground. So get this idea. That's what he's saying. Joshua put the Amalekites on their backs and his people with the edge of the sword. God gave him a great victory because he chose in that example. Here's another example of Joshua choosing. He's making the choice to stand with Caleb against the bad report. This is in Numbers chapter 14. Most of you know this story if you've been in the Bible for a while. Numbers chapter 14, Moses has the Israelites standing at the brim of the promised land, at the southernmost edge of it, in the Negev desert. And it's in a town called Kadesh Barnea. And they have the opportunity to go in and take the land. First, Moses sends in 12 spies. When they come back, Joshua's one of those spies, his buddy Caleb, and 10 other guys. 10 bring back a bad report. Only Joshua and Caleb say, don't worry about the giants. Don't worry about the walled cities. Our God is so much bigger, and it's a great land. It flows with milk and honey, and there are grapes with clusters long. Let's just go take the land and trust God. And so Joshua stood with Caleb and chose to trust God at a crisis moment in Israel's history. He stood with God. He chose to trust God. And we see this in Numbers chapter 14, verse 38. Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, which were of the men that went to search the land. They were the spies. And the text says they lived still. In fact, they lived out all their compatriots, and they were the only two from that incident at Kadesh Barnea to actually enter the promised land as a reward for choosing to go with God. Here's one more example. Joshua's life is full of examples along this line. But he also chose to follow God's battle plan against Jericho. Now, some of you have been in Sunday school. You've heard this. This is a favorite story to tell, right? God tells Joshua, you need to go in and circle this city 6 days. March your people and your army and the priests and the ark of God around the city 6 days in a row. He does that. On the seventh day, you march around it 7 times. And when you give the signal, the people shout and all the walls will fall down flat. Now, this is your first big battle, all right? Moses is now dead. This is all on you. You can't blame Moses for this one. You can't pass the buck. What are you going to do? Joshua went with God, and what was the result? We find it in Joshua 6, verse 20. So the people shouted when the priests blew with the trumpets. And it came to pass when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted with a great shout, that the wall fell down flat so that the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they took the city. It happened just the way God said. And you know why he enjoyed the result? It's because he chose to follow God. He chose to side with God. And it had paid off. Now, I don't mean to give the impression that Joshua always did the right thing or that he was a perfect leader. Certainly, I can point out mistakes as well. But he knew the importance of making a good choice and siding with God. And choosing for God is certainly worthwhile, not only in Joshua's day, but our day as well. Now, how does this apply to us? Dad, you're not going to be perfect. I'm not going to be perfect. None of us are. But we all have made hundreds of choices, which uniquely qualifies us to make recommendations on how other people ought to be choosing. Whether you've made good choices or bad choices, the fact that you've made more choices than most of the people in your home means that you're unusually qualified to encourage people to choose for God. That's why. Because of your experience and your perspective, you should be able to say to those in your house, choose you this day to serve God. I really recommend it. And you can do that whether most of your life has been bad choices or good choices. The good choices will pay off, the bad ones don't. And you know, I should have made the other choice. So this, in fact, may be the most significant thing that you ever do, is to encourage people in your home to make good choices. How do you do that? Number one, you have to make good choices. Did I put this on the notes? I don't think I did. You must also encourage those around you to make similar choices in their lives. All right, let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. Most of you know about tug of war. Most of you have been in a tug of war match. Hopefully you've been on the right side of things. But let's just imagine today that you and I come up to a tug of war battle. and it's like it's kind of hung up, and we don't know which way necessarily it's going to go. And both sides are calling out to you, join up, come over and help us. We can win this. You know what I'm going to do if I'm standing there? I'm going to be assessing the mass on either side of the middle of that rope. And you know where I'm going to throw myself? I'm going to throw myself on the side with the greater amount of mass, because it's more likely that that side is going to prevail. Now, there's really a point to this, and that's, listen, if you've gone far enough in life, you know which side of the rope has the heavyweight. And the ultimate heavyweight is God. And you ought to get over on that side and pull and encourage everyone in your house to do the same. You know, if you're going to be a father who's going to steer your family in the right direction, then one of the things you need to help them with are choices. And it starts with you making good choices. There's a second thing I see in the text that is helpful for us. In fact, kind of made this discovery as I was analyzing and working on the text this week, something that's commonly overlooked. Why don't you kind of dive into the text with me for just a moment? I've already read for you Numbers 24, 14, and 15, which ends, "But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." How do the people respond to this challenge to make this choice? Well, the people are all in. Verse 16, the people answered and said, "God forbid that we should forsake the Lord, serve other God. We ain't going to do that, Joshua. What are you thinking? We're not idiots. Man, we're with you. We're going to serve God." You know, and everyone's hooting and hollering, waving their sticks, and they got their number one fingers up in the air. "We're going with God." What does Joshua do to kind of simmer down the pot a little bit, so to speak? Well, he reminds them that they will be tempted to serve other gods. Verse 17, "For the Lord our God, He it is that brought us up and our fathers out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage." So these are the people still saying, "We're going to serve God." Verse 18, "And the Lord drove out from before us all the people, even the Amorites, which dwelt in the land," that's taking possession of the land. "Yeah, we're going to side with God, therefore we're going to serve the Lord," the people say, "for He is our God." Now look at verse number 19. And the Bible says, "Joshua said unto the people, Ye cannot serve the Lord, for He is an holy God. He is a jealous God. He will not forgive your transgressions nor your sins. If ye forsake the Lord and serve other strange gods, then He will turn and do you hurt and consume you after that He hath done you good." What Joshua is saying, listen, it's not as simple as a pep rally. It's not as simple as putting your hand up today, because when I'm dead and gone, you're going to be tempted to serve other gods and go other ways. And when you're gone, your kids, your offspring are going to be tempted to go other ways. That is always the way things go. Men and women naturally slide away from God. Just like the weeds in your yard, you don't invite them to grow there. They come up of their own volition. And so weeds of sliding away from God come up in every new generation. And aren't we seeing that today? We live in a country from the halls of education to the halls of Congress, a total disrespect for God. Not even a tolerance for God. A desire to throw God out of everything. This is not unique to America, and this is not only our problem. It is common to history. It's a challenge to get the next generation to embrace the gods that their fathers did. It's a challenge in every generation. So even though God had done so much for Israel, even though God had brought them into the promised land, and even though He had driven out their enemies from before them, the next generation might easily turn their back on serving God. So Joshua laid down the consequences. You already have it. The consequences of the decision that they're making. It's easy for someone to say to serve God, especially in a group of people like this. It's quite another to actually go home and do it. And so Joshua puts the consequences of the decision before them in terms of God's character. I want you to see this. We're going to look at God's character under the consequences. And that's the way Joshua sets it up in verse number 19. He said to the people, "Ye cannot serve the Lord." Wait a second. He just asked them to choose you this day to serve the Lord. And then he says, "You cannot serve the Lord." Is he contradicting himself? No, he's just saying it's not quite as easy as you think. It's not easy come, easy go. In fact, it isn't that way, because the God we're talking about serving is like this. He's holy. Now, we know what holy means. It means there's no sin in Him. That means he is not going to tolerate any sin in you, or to think so would be ridiculous. He's jealous. God is jealous. Some of us have a difficult time with that, but you know, you can be jealous for something in a good way, that you want to protect it from getting harmed. Men in this room want to protect their wives from being harmed by someone. You're jealous for your spouse, and that's a good thing. And so the idea he says to these Israelites is that you can serve God alongside serving other passions, other interests. That's untenable. It doesn't work that way. You cannot serve God that way. That's what he's saying. You can't serve God and love him and love other things. You've got to make up your mind. In fact, look at his conduct next. He says, not only is he holy and jealous, but he will not forgive your transgressions or your sins. We read that and we're like, huh? I thought my God's forgiving. Well, he isn't denying that God will forgive. He just is saying it's not easy come, easy go. You can't just do your own thing and then expect to put your foot on the threshold of church Sunday morning and all that baggage go away. You got to live for God all the time. All, every day of the week. Because if you don't, verse 20, he says, if you forsake the Lord and you serve strange God, he will turn and do you hurt and consume you. This is the part we don't like about God. And in some churches, you're not going to hear anything about it, but it's in the Bible. You saw it right with your own two eyes. It's right there. If you turn, if you forsake, God's going to turn on you and consume you. So, if you're up to no good, you can expect that God will be back with justice, and it ain't going to look pretty when he gets through. In other words, Joshua's saying to the people, you cannot be casual with God. You've got to consider the consequences. You're either all in or you're all out, and there isn't any middle road. Consider that. So if you're casual with God, if you flirt with the devil, God knows, and you aren't going to get away with it. Certainty of consequences needs to be stamped in our minds. Remember Proverbs chapter 15, verse 3, the eyes of the Lord are in every place, beholding the evil and the good. You know, fathers, let me talk to you for just a moment about how important it is to lay consequences before our kids. Sure, every person possesses freedom of will to make choices, and they have to suffer the consequences. But all choices, every choice has a consequence. So many young people have this idea that I can outmaneuver God or outrace reality. That I can outsmart God, and the consequences that other people suffer, that's just because they weren't as smart as me. I know how to cover my tracks better. What is it that possesses a young person to think like that? That you have all the statistics in front of them, and they still think they can fly under the radar and get away with it. And Joshua's like, no, it doesn't work that way. You cannot serve God like that. He will catch up with you. He will turn and consume you. So dads, we really need to accept the reality that a payday is coming in front of our families. If you love your children, you do want to spare them the consequences, the pain of the consequences. But honestly, consequences are a good thing because they help reinforce the validity of God's truth and our need to live for Him. Let me put it to you this way. Some parents really work too hard to spare their kids the consequences. Let me give you some examples. We stay up with them all night to finish the science project. They waited until the last minute to tell us about. Who ends up doing most of the science project? Yeah, you've been there. We pay the parking ticket or the speeding ticket because they really need the car to keep their job. Uh-oh. We bail them out of trouble by eating the cost ourselves. And I get it. I'm a parent. I don't want my kid to suffer. But sometimes consequences are a good thing. And Joshua is setting the consequences before the people so that they can really evaluate who they want to serve. Consequences are painful, but instructive. They teach us lessons our words as dads never will. Finally, let me wrap this up by talking about a third discovery I made in this chapter. Yes, it talks about choices, how important they are. Joshua also gives them the consequences if you don't serve God. That's helpful. But look with me now at the tail end of this passage. We haven't gotten to it yet. It's in verse number 24. Let's start with verse 24. 24:24, the people said unto Joshua, the Lord our God we will serve, and His voice we will obey. Hey man, we're all in. We're still in with you. We know about the choices. We've decided about the council. We're going to stick with you, Joshua. All right? Then look what Joshua says. So Joshua made a covenant with the people that day and set them a statute and an ordinance in Shechem. The third point is the commitment. This is something I don't know that many of us as dads have thought about. Let's think about this for just a moment. Joshua didn't just expect them to do right and encourage them to do right. He asked them to make a commitment. It's in verse number 25. So Joshua made a covenant. Point letter A up there is he makes them promise. He makes them promise. Honestly, we have very little control over the next generation. I read a number of quotes this week that little do we know that the kids we're raising are one day going to be setting the rules and running the show. It happens so quickly. And we can't make our kids come out a certain way or to think a certain way. But we can point them in the right direction. We can give them instruction. But we cannot make right choices for them. So Joshua had a plan. His plan involved a covenant, which is a solemn promise between two parties. Soon Joshua would be gone. Soon he wouldn't be able to coach, instruct, or correct them. So he made them promise that they would do what they said they would do. And this promise, according to verse 25, he set them a statute and an ordinance in Shechem. Shechem is the place of rule at this time, the city, for lack of a better expression, the capital, even though it wasn't the capital, it was the chief city at the time where Joshua was based out of. He's an Ephraimite, and that city was in Ephraim. I'm getting too detailed. Let me move on. Okay, so he put it down as a statute and an ordinance. In other words, he put it on the record books so that each new generation would see the statute and be reminded of the rule. But that's not all he did. Look at verse 26. And Joshua wrote these words in the book of the law of God. And he took a great stone and he set it up there under an oak that was by the sanctuary of the Lord. In the commitment, he made them promise. He set up a covenant and then he set up a memorial. Joshua did more than encourage. He put it in writing and he put up a monument. Joshua was big on monuments. Do you remember when they entered the promised land? The waters parted at the Jordan. The men took up how many stones out of the Jordan? 12 stones. They went up to Gilgal and built an altar there so they would remember the victory that God had given them through the Jordan River. Here is at the end of his life. What's he doing again? Setting up a stone. We would call it a statue, a pillar, a monument. Here is recorded this day that this people will do this thing. Why? So they would remember. It's a shame that we're taking down so many statues. We need to remember our history, not deny it happened. That was free. All right. He didn't let the fate of the nation up to chance. He went on record. He made them commit. You know, you shouldn't let the fate of your family be up to chance. Fathers need to get out in front and lead the way. They need to make it difficult for their family members to go the wrong way. Could you think about this? Imagine this scenario. Sitting down with your kids before they go off to college or out on their own, their first apartment, and say to them something like this. Your mom and I, we've invested a great deal in you. We really want the best for you, but you're about to launch out on your own. I just want you to know your mom and I will be praying for you. And on top of that, we'd like a commitment from you that you're going to stay in church and love God and serve Him. Oh, I could never get my kids to do that. Have you ever even tried? I mean, Joshua didn't want them just to hope that they would follow the Lord. He wanted them to go on record. Hey, let's put this down in a statute. Let's make it a promise. Let's put up a poll. And let's say that you committed to following God. And why is that important? They get down the road and some teenager or some other young person comes along and says, hey, have you ever tried this? Man, you try a little bit of this powder and it'll send you to the moon and back. Man, you're missing out. You know what? If your son or daughter has made a commitment, that's going to come back to their mind in that moment. And they're going to think twice about doing something that you or your God would not approve of. Make a commitment. Hey, if you want to serve God, if you want your family rather to serve God, hey, there's nothing wrong with getting out in front and pushing them in the right direction. so that they get it. That's what Joshua's doing. His time's almost through. And before you know it, Dad, your time will be through. But you can push your kids in a good way, in the right direction, the same way Joshua is trying to push this people, by having them evaluate their choices, considering the consequences, and making a personal commitment to follow the rule. A year ago, I'm going to finish this way. A year ago, my family and I took on the project of hiking Picacho Peak with the Barbas. That peak had been calling to my wife for years as she saw it in its iconic image on the horizon day after day. And she really wanted to get to the top of it. And our family had not yet taken up the effort. So while the Barbas were here a year ago, we gathered at Picacho Peak State Park, and we decided that we would go up the back side of the mountain after some deliberation. So we went up to the upper parking lot to the north of the park to start. And we hardly got out of the car. We're still putting on sunscreen, and our boys are off to the races. You know how it is with teenagers. I mean, they've done the hike twice by the time you get to the trailhead. And so they were just out in front. And I saw them taking off, and I was hanging with the Barbas, and so was my wife and my daughter. And I thought, you know what? It probably isn't wise to be out here on a hot day and my kids climbing a mountain without any adult supervision. So I thought to myself, man, I need a truck. So I girded up my loins, a biblical expression, to really make tracks. And I girded up my loins, and I think Matthew was by my side. And after a little while, about 5 or 10 minutes, I caught up to the lead group. And it was some effort. And all of us now, it's four boys and myself, we're together. And we make our way to the backside of the mountain. And we're at the base of the mountain, actually just a few feet up from the base, so we can kind of look back at the trail. And we took a break. I had an orange. Most of the boys had some water. We ate some trail mix. And we thought, we're just going to take our break till the rest of our party catches up. And we waited. And we waited. And we waited. And the rest of the party didn't show up. And so some of us are like, what kind of hat did he have on? What kind of shorts was he wearing? Did my wife have a pink hat on? And we're trying to pick out from down below which hikers might be our party. And never anybody came our direction. So finally, I get out my cell phone to check, and I have reception. So I called, and I said, where are you? She said, we're on the trail. So we waited some more. And I said, well, what part of the trail? I called her back. What part of the trail are you on? And she says, I don't know. She says, send me a picture. This really happened. So I took a picture of where I was, and I sent it to her by text. And she says, we're not near there. And she called. She had a brochure or something. She called the base, the ranger station. And she explained where she was. And she was at the southernmost side of the mountain. She had totally... And we learned later that there was a part where the trail split and wasn't well marked. And while she needed to go left toward the base of the mountain with the Barbas, their party went right and skirted the mountain and missed it completely. The truth about it is, she never got up the mountain that day. And only my boys and I were able to celebrate at the top. Now, there is a lesson in this rather humorous story. It's humorous now, it wasn't that day.
I've since made it up.
It's not enough to get your family on the right trail. You need to be sure that you get them, push them in the right direction so they reach the right destination. Dads, this is our job. Let us own it, and let us encourage our families to serve God until, like Joshua, we take our final breath. Let's pray together.